Y'all ready for this?
What's up, bodybuilding.com listeners? My name is Danielle Bitz, and today I'm joined by Rachel Mariotti. Rachel is a licensed mental health therapist here in New York City, as well as professional fitness coach. Her main focus in mental health treatment is building habits in order to grow mental resilience while addressing the physical and spiritual side of a person's being. Rachel began her work in a psychoanalytic clinic setting, treating patients with depression and anxiety. While in pursuit of her license, she started her own practice called Mental Hygiene, which is focused on building habits around mindfulness, emotional awareness, and breaking down negative beliefs through understanding words and reactions. She's been featured in Women's Health as a mental health expert, was hired by Nike to speak on the mind-body connection, as well as by Athleta as a mental health advisor for their women's online community. Rachel has her master's degree in applied psychology from NYU and an NCSF certification in personal training. Rachel, welcome to the BBCom podcast.
Thank you, Danielle.
For the conversation that we have today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. We had a good phone call before this, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was telling you, we've worked with a number of your colleagues at Bodybuilding so far. Shout out to Gabe and Megan and a couple others of the crew. So excited to bring you in, excited to introduce you to our audience. I think we have something really valuable for everyone listening out there today.
Agreed.
Let's get into it. You know, when we first spoke a couple of weeks back, you were telling me a little bit about these six pillars of wellness that you typically like to start out with when you have a new client or athlete that you're working with. What are these six pillars and how do they really affect our daily well-being? Let's break those down.
Yeah, so to clarify, the six pillars is an assessment tool I use for mental hygiene clients, not for personal training clients. And really, I'm not telling people what to do with these six pillars. I'm more so gauging their expectations around where they're at. And the six pillars are exercise, diet, and sleep are the first three, and then relationships, mental health, and purpose are the latter three. So the first three are really looking at the body and how a client who's wanting to work on a specific area of their mental health, how they're handling their body and what their expectations are. And I have them rate each pillar 1 to 10. So it just gives me, it gives me a sense, this is done on the first session, and it gives both of us a sense of, okay, I actually didn't realize I could spend more time in my relationships, or I didn't realize how much I wasn't connected with my purpose, meaning my work or my, you know, general life purpose, which, you know, many of us seem to lose sight of, that, you know, we value our work so much that it becomes our, or it feels like it's our entire self-worth, and we're spending less time being present in other areas of our life outside of work. So the latter three pillars are really where more, you know, sensitive, important conversations come up. I mean, the body side of the being is also important, and, you know, there's some information in sleep. If we're losing sleep, usually it's tied to our mental health. What's keeping you up at night? So it's just it's a gauge of how someone's handling their life. And I guess I never called it six pillars of wellness, but you can consider it that. But I don't, you know, strictly label it that.
You hinted a couple minutes ago, you said, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on exercise and work. Is that typically the same pattern that you're seeing a lot with the clients that you're working with? Where of those six pillars are they spending a majority of their time? And where do you try to really coach them and guide them into spending a little more time?
I think there's not an over-exaggeration of people working out too much when we fill out the six pillars, or at least I don't see people rating themselves too low. Generally, everybody I talk to is in a good mental space and meeting their expectations with their exercise and diet. I've had a few clients who are, you know, maybe a little too extreme with their food, and that ties into the mental and ties into other, you know, really ties into other areas of their life when it's all said and done, when we're being extreme with food. But Yeah, the purpose pillar and the relationships pillar where we spend the most time usually. And mental health is kind of a reflection of those things.
Well, can you give us an example of you know, maybe a recent client, a past client, et cetera, and the process that you typically follow?
Sure. Let me think of I mean, the most recent one is someone who does overwork themselves. And he's a doctor, and he has his own practice, and he's running into a new situation. His exercise, diet, and sleep are actually in a great place. But there's some road bumps happening in his work, and it's causing issues. It's causing more resistance and not conflict, but stress in his family. So that's when we focus more on present thinking and understand, okay, well, where are the thoughts coming from, and you know, are they too extreme? Can we dial them down a little bit in order to handle the moment in a, you know, a high stress work environment? But another example is a woman I started talking to who's on the social front, can, you know, she's yearning for more social connection just based on her environment. She's not in New York City, she's in Canada, but you know, she's more socially isolated. So her connection is through the internet, really. And, you know, it ends up tying into mental health. You start spending so much time with yourself. You spend more time in your head. You compare yourself to other people on social media. And in those cases, I see diet and exercise and sleep in a good place, because if those aren't in a good place, then everything is starting to lose its stability. So there are a couple flags that I see. When exercise, diet, and sleep are in a great place, it's still a yellow flag to me. I'm like, okay, well, this is stable. Something else is unstable. That's not always the case, but I'm starting to form that theory.
Awesome. Yeah. In the clients that you typically work with, what are some of the blockers that we're running into the most? Is it anxiety? Is it depression? Is it more so just dealing with everyday life and learning how to truly balance, right? And, you know, we like to throw around the saying work-life balance, right? You could also argue that there is no such thing. We're kind of in
no,
this
there's no such thing. There's is this, it? In Sweden, there's a such thing.
Yeah.
But in the United States, there's no such thing.
Exactly. So how, especially in the United States, you know, how do we begin to even kind of cope with the overwhelming, you know, daily lives that we've kind of embedded ourselves in?
Well, New York is it's just a completely abnormal place to live. And people come here because they want to work and they want to further their careers. So there's already a mindset that you buy into. And so I don't really compare New Yorkers to everyone else, but there are bigger general trends. I think, to go back to your question, anxiety is what I see more than depression with my clients and with myself. I think maybe that's a vibe attracts your tribe type of thing. You know, I talk about mental health on Instagram. I have a certain way of talking about it. I have certain experiences, and therefore it garners a certain audience that reaches out to me who maybe end up wanting to do mental hygiene sessions. But generally, I see more anxiety out there than depression. That's just what I see. But I look at it as a positive thing. People do want to better themselves. And with that comes anxiety. I mean, if you want to better your career, if you want to be better than the next person, you got to start working harder, and you got to start going into unknown territory with what you're doing with your life. And that's a recipe for anxiety, but it's useful. You know, I know we'll talk about athletes. Athletes have anxiety, but it's very channeled, and there's a lot more pressure, and there's a goal. There's a clear goal, which is different than life. There's no clear goals with once you get out of college, you know, unless you are a doctor.
Right. You know. Right. You say mental hygiene, and that's the name of your private branding, right? So why mental hygiene? You know, why not? What led you to mental hygiene as the naming convention?
I started mental hygiene in 2017 when I was at the clinic, and hygiene was the first word that came into my mind. And I'm leaning actually more toward mental resilience now, but mental hygiene is hygiene, as you would, you know, think of it for your physical hygiene, or things that human beings have disciplined themselves to do in order to
brushing your teeth, flossing, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, 300 years ago, were we brushing our teeth? I don't know. Maybe we were, but dental hygiene has certainly become a discipline,
right?
Because we've recognized that it actually impacts our health. But we actually had to train ourselves to brush our teeth. You know, at one point, we weren't brushing our teeth. And maybe in, you know, I know maybe in other areas of the world they still don't do that. But I mean, but things like that, and you know, taking care of your skin and taking care of, you know, your physical hygiene, taking showers. I mean, I know these are very rudimentary things now because we can laugh at them now. But what about our mental side of things? You know, our brains are now computing far more content and information now than we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago. We're way more connected. So where's the discipline? You know, are we going to be 50 years behind? Who wants to learn this first so we can survive longer at a better quality? Sign me up.
Same.
So I think that's what I've been curious about since I, you know, since I moved to New York, really. I mean, I moved to New York and I was like, whoa, there's a lot more people here. This is a lot of stimulus.
Where? Move from where?
From Ohio, yeah.
Okay.
Shout out to Midwest people, where it's simple and there probably is a better quality of life, but I chose not to do that. And, you know, I stuck it out. I'm still here for 13 years, but I think for the better. But I realized that that made me really curious about just human interaction, human behavior, and psychology. And, you know, I learned more about my own mental health through my behavior and my body, you know, through working out and going to the extremes of it, going to the extremes of diet, and physically being burnt out from it. I was also in my 20s. Everybody does dumb things in their 20s. So I cut myself some slack there. And if you're in your 20s screwing up your nervous system, I think it's normal, you know. I don't think it's normal when you reach your late 20s and your early 30s, considering, you know, maybe we're growing up a little bit later now. The end of adolescence is technically now 25, not 19. And that's been said by psychologists. I'm not just making that up. So there's societal shifts that cause us to develop a little bit later, and maybe we have more time to screw up, which is good. But, you know, when I was in my early 20s, it was so extreme that it was damaging, you know, eating disorder, you know, just very extreme thinking. There's no room for middle ground, so it's a lot of negative thinking. And it, you know, the high anxiety can lead to depression. And especially that layered in with loneliness and, you know, just inconsistency with friendships, and specifically in the city, can feel really depressing. So the way I handled it was exercise and diet, but too extreme. And, you know, that eventually, and this is how the six pillars really have formed for me. You know, it was my relationships, but really my purpose that led me to some kind of stability. And then I was able to be like, okay, I can actually, you know, be a little bit more gentle, or actually feel like I can be more gentle. I feel more safe to, you know, not be so hard on myself with extreme thinking about food or extreme thinking about working out. And I think I really have made a leap in the last 2 years. So, and that came with a lot of, I think, in some ways, spirituality. I moved out of New York and came back, and that gave me a lot of perspective, and a lot of perspective about people, my energy, about fitness, I moved to South Florida, which was very fitness oriented city, but for a different reason. It's not to blow off your stress and to numb yourself. It's because people actually enjoy fitness.
And they want to move their body and they just want to feel good at the end of the day.
And they want to work out 6 hours a day. And I actually think that 6 hours is way healthier than the 2 hours that New Yorkers want to crush themselves.
Yeah.
And maybe things are changing. And I'm holding this earlier period of my New York lifestyle and kind of conflating that with what I see in the fitness industry. I think people are generally more balanced, but I still see an overexertion of the nervous system just visually. I'm like, it's too much.
Yeah, I mean, you made a valid point. I mean, anxiety translating to very intense bouts of exercise, very intense bouts of movement, just to sort of kind of kill that voice, die that voice down a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And just, you know, go for a long run. Okay, I feel better. Great, I got, quote unquote, I got the demons out, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how does someone begin to recognize that that is anxiety? Maybe they don't even realize that they're overworking and they're outworking themselves to just the point of pure physical and emotional exhaustion at the end of the day. How do they really begin to take a step back and realize why, you know, what's fueling that?
That's a great question. And I hope I can answer it clearly to maybe guide some people to, you know, balancing out their physical body and their mental state. It's not always clear, though. I think if there's negative thinking or fear driving you to the gym, even if it's just a little bit, and these come down to the automatic negative thoughts, I call them ants, and this is coming from another psychologist that calls them ants, automatic negative thoughts. That, you know, if there's a little bit of fear driving you to the gym or doubt about your body, you need to take more time for your mental health and not numb your mind at the gym as much. I mean, I don't have that fear. I haven't had that fear going to exercise in the last at least 2 years. And maybe even longer. And that's a blessing, because there were always doubts and body image conflicts that I've had. Even if they became more subtle, I could recognize when they were non-existent. And you can observe how you go about your diet also, because it seems like those are paired up. Exercise and diet are paired up in the fitness industry a lot. So that's when I think you can start to understand, okay, maybe I could pay more attention to mental health. And, you know, there's a professor and neuroscientist, Alan Watkins. He has a TED Talk. It's from like 2017. I watched it a few weeks ago. I don't know a lot about this guy, but he said something very important in this TED Talk, was that, you know, in terms of emotional awareness and the importance of it, is that we will numb ourselves first by going out on the weekends drinking. I mean, that used to be kind of a culture, and it still is. And it's fun. The work culture has changed, but people go numb themselves by binge drinking on the weekends. And then it turns into you become obsessed with work, or you start to distract your mental health with work or sex or working out. You go to the gym, pump some weights, and your mind, you know, becomes numb. It's not meditation. It's not mindfulness. Yes, you might be present when you're working out, and I think it's great. Honestly, we should all work out the adequate amount to take care of our health. But I think it's good to start questioning, okay, well, how much are we spilling over into numbing maybe what we could be thinking about a little bit more, which is our emotional health and as it relates to our relationships and our own self-worth, right? Being okay with what you have right now and knowing that there's plenty of possibilities and opportunities out there to, you know, move your life in the right direction on the spectrum of time.
Right. You know, we talk a lot about aesthetic-driven goals. We talk a lot about body dysmorphia, specifically, and probably can pertain to a lot of our listeners out there, right, who may have experienced it in the sport of bodybuilding, or maybe just as athletes in general. And this is going to start to shift our conversation into more athletics. You know, how do we get to a point where we're not purely training for the figure that's looking back at us in the mirror, right? When we're sitting in there in the gym, and how do we begin to differentiate a performing body versus maybe a quote unquote aesthetically pleasing body? Because those two aren't mutually exclusive. To be able to perform and be a top of the line marathon runner or triathlete or CrossFitter or bodybuilder, let's not say bodybuilding, right? Let's say any of these performing sports, right? You're going to need to focus on performance over aesthetics in order to get the glute strength that you may need to be a premier cyclist, you know, to get the core strength that you're going to need to be a really great swimmer, right? Mm. So how do we kind of begin to differentiate the line between training for performance and training for aesthetics, and without getting too wrapped up in aesthetics when performance is the goal?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And the first thought that came to my head was that we as human beings, especially given our media structure, we all have a hard time living in ambiguity. It's really difficult for someone's mind to be saying, I want to be strong, but I also want to be, for women, I want to be lean and slender.
Right.
And, or I want to be the athlete that I was when I was 22 or 17 or whatever age, but I also want to look good for a partner that I'm trying to attract. Mm-hmm. So that just takes time. I think my message would be, don't be too hard on yourself. That will all sort itself out, which doesn't relieve people's anxiety in the now. But I think if you sit and think about it and understand what you're saying to yourself, you know, if what's the value of trying to be like you were when you're 17 and trying to sprint as fast? It makes you feel good in the moment, but if it feels like you're a hamster on the wheel, what aren't you looking at? And if attracting a partner is more important to you, are you ignoring yourself? And are you ignoring something? You know, maybe attracting a partner is more valuable to you. And maybe that's a scary thing. You're not going to figure it out by running 15 miles an hour on the skill mill. You know, it will help you feel alleviated in the moment. But when you go back home and you feel lonely, and I'm referring back to my 22-year-old self, you have to sit with those thoughts and start to redirect that anxiety into, okay, I'm going to accept parts of myself and try to attract a partner if that's what I think I want, and see how that feels. And I guarantee you, in that moment, you try to pay attention to the other feelings, you will feel relief, even if it doesn't work out. And there's anxiety in trying new things. I mean, the dating scene in New York is terrifying for a lot of people, but why does it have to be terrifying? It can be a new experience, and in the process you are learning about yourself versus numbing yourself with work or workouts, right, or, you know, whatever it may be.
Right. And this may be maybe talking to trainer Rachel and coach Rachel for a second here, but I mean, it's fair to say that we have to choose between aesthetics and performance at the end of the day, right? So, I mean, if you're going to run the New York City Marathon, I mean, your body's going to do what it needs to do if you expect to perform well. And I'll use myself as an example here. I mean, 18-year-old Danielle going into a Division I program, and immediately, you know, putting on muscle that I was building muscles that I didn't even know I had at the time, let's put it that way, mm-hmm. right? And me being fearful during that period, because seeing upperclassmen at the time and seeing what they look like at 18 versus what they look like at 21 after 4 years of that type of strength and conditioning, mm-hmm. I was scared. I was like, I don't want to look like that. At the same time, it's, well, this is the body you sort of need to build to perform well in this sport. And I think I fought
What was your sport?
Softball. Mm-hmm. So I was a power athlete. You know, it was about that first step. It was about getting your hips through a swing as powerful as you can.
And you didn't want to look.
And I didn't
like
want to. I didn't want to quote unquote get bulky, even though the term of women getting bulky is just so outdated at this time. And I think I really fought that hard, and I didn't fuel myself. I didn't feed myself the way I needed to for those 4 years. And I don't think I reached my highest potential because today I'm sitting here doing half Ironmans, and 18-year-old Danielle wouldn't even dream of doing that. And I'm fueling myself properly. I have more muscle than I did at 18 to 22 during that program, right? And I care a little less about aesthetics at the end of the day because I'm like, oh my gosh, look, I can go and do a half Ironman for 5-6 hours, and my body can do these three movements for hours and hours and hours. And I'm more proud about that at this point than I was, you know, than I think I can say in the 4 years of that program, because I'm just so, I guess I'm grateful that I have a body that's able to do this, and I want to continue to push the limits to see what else it can do and worry a little less about what my body looks like in the process of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally understand that, and I can resonate with that a little bit, being a track athlete in college, a sprint athlete, where you really got to put on some serious leg muscle. And I was eating like I felt like a linebacker. I'm like, this is a lot, and I feel heavy, and I didn't necessarily like it. And you know, 18 to 21, the scope of our long-term values is very narrow. So that's the time where you screw up, and there's all these extreme thinking or extreme types of thinking. When, you know, how old are you now?
30.
So yeah, I think I'm 33. I know at 40, I'll have completely different views. I mean, some overlapping views and values, I'm sure. But I think as we continue down the road of time, our values become broader, and that is a relief on our nervous system. So the, you know, 20s to 30s is extremely volatile, but I see there can be a lot of room for improvement with emotional awareness. And even in our 30s, given that we are all kind of tied to social media and connection and comparison, and I think managing that is important. But yeah, I think to go back to your point about aesthetics and the conflict there, the ego is, you know, very strong in early 20s, and there are parts of us, for me specifically, sports played into my social status. So I'm under this belief coming from my 15-year-old self that if I'm good at sports, people will like me. And that was a conditioning that happened just being in middle school and high school. I saw that I became better at sports. I started making more friends. That felt good. Keep doing that. And it could be a reason why I went into fitness. I think I don't see it not tying into why I decided to choose fitness as a career, because I looked at myself in my early fitness career Instagram posting, and I'm posting how I'm athletic, and I'm posting I can jump on a box that's higher than you, and and I can sprint faster than you, and this became a, you know, this helped my Instagram following, but you know, I don't have that many followers, but it certainly plays with your ego all the way through your 20s, and you think this is important. You know, I thought it was important, and maybe it is to a certain degree with business, but it's really not that important. It's the message, and the message is more important. And I found that my message earlier on in my career with fitness, which is why I went into mental health as a professional, was that work out a lot and be athletic and be lean like me and be cool. You know, that was my message basically. And it was not healthy. You know, behind the scenes, I'm like spinning my wheels on how I'm looking, and am I going in the right direction with my life? And I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling depressed. And I'm putting my extreme workouts on a pedestal. Like, you can be lean like me. But I guess I didn't also, you know, market the fact that you will be anxious and depressed like me too if you do this.
Right.
So I think my bias when I look at fitness in general is that. I don't think everybody's like that, but I still believe that we are overtaxing our nervous system by numbing ourselves with exercise too much.
And I think it becomes an identity at a certain point, right? Especially younger athletes. You know, let's talk about athletes specifically here for a second, even mm-hmm. though we've really moved into that. You know, how an athlete's mindset transitions into mental durability. And I think we're kind of talking about the negative side of it right now. So let's keep that going, and then we'll flip it to the positive. If an athlete starts a sport, let's say 8 or 9, they're starting early and early these days. I mean, they're going for scholarships at 11, 12 years old at this mm-hmm. point. So, you know, someone starting
recipe
a sport.
Recipe for anxiety.
Yeah. Yes. Let's talk about it. You know, they're starting a sport at 8 and 9. They're getting really, really great at the sport. 10, 11, 12. Okay. 13, 14, 15. Let's start recruiting. Okay. Now I have to be number one because I have to be sought out by the one scout that's going to be coming here to look at mm-hmm. thousands of athletes in a weekend. Okay. Now I got into college. All right. Now I have to work my way into the starting lineup. Okay. Great. Now I'm number one. Now I want to be all American, right? Okay. Now I want to go pro when I'm done with college. So mm-hmm. this starts from such a young age. What happens when it ends? Because it will end. And that's what a lot of people, younger people, don't realize. I didn't realize it at a certain point. It became my identity. My sport certainly did. When it ends, they are facing complete mental crises. I mean, they are experiencing, in for lack of a better word, an identity crisis. They don't really know who they are without this sport, without the training, without somebody telling them where and where they have to be and when they have to be there and how much they have to practice for this one thing that they've set their sights on, right? So let's talk about that range, you know, that time span that of where it's such a fixated duration, and then that ends, right? And what happens? How do they transition into
sure.
normal life?
Sure, yeah. Well, it's something that a lot of people can relate to, for sure. You know, spending that much time in a sport. I was in gymnastics at age 4, and I really didn't stop sports until I was 18. And, you know, for those that are out there following that scenario, more extreme, going, you know, elite, All-American, and pro, and then it comes to an end, I think it can end up in a crisis if there are, depending on a lot of things. I mean, if you're not emotionally aware of what's going on, you're generally not, between the ages of 10 and 25, let's just call it 20, but, you know, the emotional awareness aspect of the fact that this is not necessarily how it's, this is not sustainable, this type of effort. And if you're emotionally aware of that, if you are seeing a counselor and you are seeing a therapist or one of the two, and your parents are supporting you no matter what type of performance you come out with, that helps. But the ego in that process, if you are becoming that good and there's not really a lot of emotional awareness, it could end up in a crash and burn scenario, and it, you know, that can get pretty ugly. But generally, most people don't, you know, end up in worst case scenarios like suicide from that and such an identity shift, because they end up having something else to focus on, like work or, you know, getting a job, and then that transition is rocky or less, more or less rocky for certain people. But I do think the emotional awareness and counseling through those times is very important, which is generally why we should all be going to therapists, even if we're in a more subtle transition, like going from 38 to 40, you know, or and when you enter a new decade, or when you break up with somebody, or when you move to a new place, or whatever transition, when you lose somebody, there's always transitions happening, just not as greatly as that. So I think, you know, to speak to your audience, I know there's a lot of athletes, just recognize, you know, what parts of your ego you're still holding on to that you can not let go of, but maybe attach to and put value to your new identity, whatever that may be. Whether that's, I want to be a good stand-up person to attract a partner or to start a family, or, you know, I don't know what it is. I don't have the best advice here. I'm still figuring it out. My life, you know, my identity crisis right now, if you want to call it a crisis, it's not a crisis, but I'll become a mother in 2 months. Yeah, who the heck knows how I'm going to handle that, you know? And I think I've done a good job of letting go of my ego as an athlete, I think. I'm pretty sure. You know, I still want a nice body after I have a kid, but I don't think I'm going. I think I value more being gentle on my nervous system than, you know, having a six pack or even just having a lean stomach. I mean, I would like to have a lean stomach after having a baby. I know that, but I think when it runs into me having negative thoughts and me taxing my nervous system, then I'll say, okay, well, so be it. I'm not going to have a lean stomach for another 6 months. I can handle that. I think I'm confident that I'll have that mindset. Just because I'm okay not being 25 anymore, you know?
And you're not willing to put yourself through the stress that it would take to cut that timeline in half. Say, you know, let me be less stressed and get to that finish line or get to that goal in 6 months from now, as opposed to making myself absolutely crazed and getting there 3 months from now, even if that was achievable. And it very well could be, right? You could you could immediately get back out there and run yourself into the ground. That would be ill-advised, obviously, but you could, and I'm sure there are people out there that do it. But to have just, let's say, emotional maturity, let's say, to just take a step back and realize my body needs time to heal. My body needs time to go through this transition right now. And I'm going to prioritize mental health over the physical right now in terms of getting back to what I'm hoping to get back to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was thinking while you were saying that the support that I have and the support that anybody has from a partner or good friends really matters. And none of this is done alone. I mean, I think my emotional maturity is a result of taking risks to find good people to support me. So the taking risk part is anxiety, but, you know, once you verbalize where you're at in your life and you find acceptance, you can start bringing in people that can support you for who you are right now. And that does relieve your nervous system, and that makes you feel safe enough where you're like, okay, I don't have to look perfect all the time. I feel I have people that look like me the way I am right now. That's great. So, but you have to be willing to put yourself out there and accept yourself the way you are right now to get those people in your life. I really believe that. It's all a reflection. So it's a little bit of risk taking in terms of accepting yourself, you know?
Yep, absolutely. You know, not only the personal support, but also just the professional support, just going back to, you know, the life of an athlete, we're seeing more and more implementation of mental health resources in the collegiate landscape, even at the high school level. I'm even seeing it. Shout out to where I went to school, Hofstra University on Long Island. They just hired their first director of mental health for their athletic department. And I'm like, wow. And I just took a step back. I'm like, that's huge.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
It's massive.
It's a good message.
And, you know, when one of us, you know, I experienced a couple injuries, my teammates experienced a couple injuries, and they kind of just shuffle you over into the general counseling department for the university, which is fine. It's great that that's part of their process. But to have someone in there now who has a viewpoint of the day-to-day of what these athletes are going through, to really understand what it means that they're now injured, they're now taken out of this sport, they're not going to be able to physically exercise for 3, 4, 6 a year, right? That's massive. And I hope that continues. I hope we continue to see that shift at those levels.
Yeah. It's all a matter of the spectrum of time that you're working with as an individual. I mean, if your anxiety is just about performing for the next 3 years, then the counselor is probably going to focus on the next 3 years versus let me make you more emotionally mature for the rest of your life. That's not realistic. So yeah, I think, but the micro is being able to manage your mental in those micro months or years, especially when it's something as big as like an injury and you can't perform, super important. And that will translate into, you know, the emotional resilience and being able to shift gears in other big life transitions, for sure.
What's your advice for, you know, an athlete in any sport and in any, let's say, level, you know, of the emotional and mental roller coaster that's surely to come when they experience an injury? Everybody's going to get hurt. Everybody's going to get injured at some point, and it's always going to depend on what you're experiencing, of how long you're going to be out. But what's the first piece of advice you have to offer someone when they get hurt and they can't go through with their daily routine?
Well, I fortunately haven't been through any serious injury where it set me back. But the first thing that came to my head was to have the support system you need. I think most people naturally seek out comfort through other people when it's something that large or significant. But to keep your mind moving, on something that you enjoy, if you're physically, you know, disabled short term, there has to be other things that you may be interested in that you may find joy in. So it's all about a matter of where you put your attention. I mean, if I were to get seriously injured right now and I'm disabled, I would probably tell myself, well, what's other things that I can enjoy with my mind, and to keep my mind active and, you know, for survival reasons, but for, you know, also not, you know, beating myself up and getting in my own head. It's all just a matter of where I put my focus. And that can be that's the same advice I tell somebody if they're in their own head, if they're looking at Instagram too much. It's really a matter of where you're putting your focus. You know, you can put your focus on comparing yourself, but you can put your focus on things that you enjoy too. It's harder for some people depending on, you know, their psychological profile and their time perception and all of that. But yeah, injury, you know, I've had some mental hygiene clients that who've been through a long history of injury, and it's, some of them are chronic, and it's almost become part of them that if they don't feel injured, if they don't feel somewhat not as good as the other people, then they actually lose their identity, and that becomes another problem.
What about something you just said reminded me? I mean, what about the individuals out there who they have to feel sore? They always have to feel beat up. If they don't feel beat up and just absolutely wrecked after a workout,
I love those people.
Like, destroy myself,
really entertaining,
7 days a week.
Well, that used to be me. Maybe not 7 days a week. I think you see more men that are kind of like this. You know, I have a couple colleagues one of my colleagues at work, shout out to Jason. He works out with his buddy all the time, and they're always just going hard. And his friend joked around that, you know, I'm always in zone four every 45 minutes. And they both look great. But, you know, I think to each their own. At the end of the day, if your mental is struggling, then maybe that's time to redirect some of the attention. If you want to go hard 7 days a week and you can manage doing it and you could perform that well and you can maintain good sleep and you can maintain your hormonal balance and you can maintain good relationships and you can maintain, you know, taking risks to find a partner or find new friends, then go hard 7 days a week. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But if one of those things are starting to falter and cause issues for your mental health or your nervous system, but you have to pay attention to these things, you know?
Right, absolutely. Let's talk about the positive effects of being an athlete and transitioning into everyday life, right? You know, let's go back to that 8 and 9 year old who worked so long, you know, a decade plus, to become the very best that they could be at something, right? How does that translate into relationships and the workplace and just everyday life, you know, past the college level or past whatever level it is that they, quote unquote, retired from.
I missed the first part. How does what translate?
What are the positive benefits of being an athlete and you know, being a competitive performance athlete, right? You've gone through extreme training. You've been a part of a team dynamic. How does that translate into just normal life?
Well, when you're an athlete, you have to be present. So that's a positive. You have to be present on the field. As Sam Harris, who's a neuroscientist, he would phrase it, you know, when you're an athlete, you're as close to the present moment as you can be. And that's the same with sex. That's why these things are euphoric and they feel great, because we're so close to the present moment. So I think that's a great experience to be an athlete. When else do we get to be present? I mean, 50% of the time our attention is diverted to other things, not the present moment. That's true. It's 47%. We are not thinking about the present moment. So being an athlete, automatically, I'm like, well, that's a great experience. And you're moving your body and you're challenging your body. You're making it more resilient by risk taking. That's a huge positive. So automatically the body remembers that. It has a store of that memory. And I think if that's something that you want to repeat through exercise, that could be a positive experience. It's a positive experience to challenge your body through exercise. And you can certainly be present and you keep your breath on a rhythm for 60 minutes, 45 to 60 minutes. So those are certainly positives, maybe short-term, more short-term positives. And I think the discipline to get yourself up and push yourself. Now, once again, going back to the subtle fear or doubt that people may have to drive themselves to the gym is not discipline. And let's be clear. If you have a little bit of fear because you're looking in the mirror and you're saying, I ate too much last night, I need to go to the gym, maybe some of that's discipline, but you're more being driven by fear. And I think it's important to distinguish that. But the people that are getting up and pushing themselves and actually balancing their zone 2 cardio and their strength training and their mobility, it takes discipline. And I think being an athlete, you have the coach and you have the schedule and someone pushing you. And that's a big, you know, important translation into real life.
Yep.
And taking care of your body.
Absolutely. All great points. Let's shift, no pun intended, to the great shift, how a post-pandemic society places emphasis on longevity. Let's talk about why it's taken a pandemic for us to put a little more emphasis on longevity-based goals as opposed to performance and aesthetic-based goals. Sure, those types of goals still exist, but why are we a little less focused on burning ourselves out in our 20s, our 30s, and 40s, and our mind is shifting to the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, right? What do you think has caused that shift?
Well, you know, I think the pandemic obviously was a frightening thing. I mean, to be clear, it scared the shit out of a lot of us, especially in April 2020 in New York City specifically. I mean, I was wiping off my grocery bags and afraid I was going to kill somebody, you know, like, so I think just to be mindful of that, it was a scary time, but it also caused us to slow down and accelerate certain parts of our lives, the things that we may have been not paying attention to. And see what happens when the world stops, when the stock market stops, when you're sitting at home and you don't have to follow the same inertia of the day. It's an actual physical slowing down. And when you're able to slow down, then what I saw and what I did with my life, you know, I see this with a lot of people in New York, was they actually started to take action on the things that they've been thinking about, which is moving out of New York, having kids, traveling the world, you know, not being a super spreader, but traveling the world. And so I think that's the same message that I'm trying to say of working out too much is maybe is maybe making you overlook the moments you could be slowing down to take better care of your long-term health. But I agree with you that it's shifted our focus to longevity. There's certainly that word has popped up more. Women's health has been more of a conversation. I've heard more about periods than in the last year than I've ever heard. I can't believe I'm 33 and I'm learning more about periods. I'm like, wow, this is great.
Yep, all new information. This is wonderful.
How does this information come about? I hope guys learn about it too. I think it's important. I want to learn more about men's hormonal health. But yes, I think we think more about our 70s and 80s because we were able to slow down and recognize that there are values to thinking this way. And when we're better at connecting the dots long term to now, it's an immediate relief. You start to, solidify your values, and that has a big impact on our mental health.
Yeah, I view it as this this giant oh shit moment, right? It was, I'm either not living up to sort of my own expectations, not in an extreme manner, but also I'm doing way too much. And I was someone who fell into that category of the second I didn't have to go into an office, I'm fully remote now. Shout out to bodybuilding.com. but at the time, my routine was get up at 5 a.m, try to go to the gym before I go to the office. You're in the office all day, 6 o'clock. You're going and doing maybe another yoga class after work. You're going to meet up with people after work. And you're looking at 18-hour days. And then you're getting 6 hours of sleep average, right? Today, I get 8.5, 9 hours of sleep. And I feel the best that I have. So just seeing shifts in sleep habits, seeing shifts in nutritional habits. And then, of course, the physical habits too. Do I really need to be putting in 100-mile months, is that necessary, right? So I like to call it the oh shit moment for all of us collectively, and just to
definitely
take a step back. And
8.5, 9 hours. Jeez, I'm jealous. Yeah, do you track it on a watch?
Yeah, I have a Whoop. Yeah.
You have a Whoop watch?
Yeah, yeah. I have Whoop.
I track my sleep on my Oura Ring. It's not a plug for them or anything, but I like tracking my sleep.
No, let's get into them for a second. I mean, with these devices now, they have started implementing, female cycle tracking, right? Menstruation tracking and,
Yeah, that kind of bug, it bothers me for some reason. I don't know. How can you track someone's cycle through a ring?
Well, it's the same as HRV, I feel. I don't feel that we're at the... Let's remove the devices that we're talking about.
It's like McDonald's offering salads. I'm like, it's kind of a stretch.
Yeah. But accuracy aside for a moment, just the point that you made, right? We're talking about it now. It shouldn't have taken this long. The fact that we're talking about it, the fact that efforts are being made to help female athletes, across the globe really implement this into how they go about their training schedule. And I want to talk about that. You wrote a really great piece recently.
Oh, you read it?
Yeah, I read it. It was great. We'll link it in this episode. But it was just a really great first-person experience of, how the menstruation cycle impacts your daily life, not just your training routine. I would love for you to just tell everybody a little bit about it.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to lose the men here, but I think it's important that we all support each other in our own hormonal health and
guys, listen up. It's important for you.
I'm not going to dive too deep here, but I think the culture of fitness has driven women to work out too much and not pay attention to their hormonal health. And now that's becoming a conversation. So it makes me wonder what's going on with men. Men have their own pressures of making more money and providing for a family. And I mean, that's the outer pressure, societal pressure that and then I don't know in terms of body image for how it goes for men, but men have a circadian rhythm, men have testosterone, men need to have sleep, and women, we have a circadian rhythm, but we have the infraradian rhythm. This is something that I learned as of the last year. I'm not an expert here. This is, this is coming from a podcast from Alyssa VT, who started the Flow app. And I use that currently because I'm pregnant. And what I talked about in the article was my journey in losing my menstrual cycle. So the infraradian rhythm of a woman is during her reproductive years, She has, you know, a cycle, and it's a fluctuation of estrogen and progesterone, essentially. And those things cause different energy balances. So when estrogen is rising or falling, you may feel more tired or fatigued or whatever. I don't know the exact, you know, rise and fall, but there are four phases to the cycle during a woman's reproductive years. So paying attention to that is important. And I the article that I wrote was that your menstrual cycle can be your therapist if you don't have one. And, you know, funny enough, and I'm happy to have heard this from other podcasters like Tim Ferriss and Andrew Huberman, they had mentioned that if you are taking care of your reproductive cycle, and I think that goes for men too, that, you know, if men have a low sperm count, maybe it's time to reassess what you're doing with your mental health and physical health. And for women, if you're not having a cycle, what's going on with your nervous system? What are areas of your health that you can focus on? And that was my therapist. That's what I, you know, I said, I paid attention to my cycle. I lost it for 7 years. I was overworking out, and I was working out too much, rather. And I was being extreme with my diet. I was doing intermittent fasting. I was doing stupid cleanses. And I didn't have a period. I was also very stressed. And I think things like irritable bowel syndrome and infertility and irregular cycle can be tied to a series of things. And some of it is genetic. I can't speak for everyone, but exercise, stressing the nervous system too much, was something that I recognized in my journey. And also now being pregnant, I started ramping up my exercise again, and I like to do intense. And this is part of my ego, seeing other people on Instagram wanting to compete a little bit, showing that I still got it. My doctor's like, no, just slow down. Just relax. And that, you know, it's, there's part of, you know, my feelings were, there was a subtle, you know, feeling of shame. I'm like, what's wrong with me that I can't work out as intensely as other people who are also pregnant that are working out? And then I kind of came to terms with it. I'm like, there's things that I don't know. And honestly, like, what's the bigger problem here? What's the bigger value here? Is keeping myself healthy so I can keep the baby healthy? I mean, it's another human. And then there's also part of me that's like, I don't mind not working out, actually. But I don't want to get too cozy there. I mean, I know I'll discipline myself. But my message from that experience is that, you know, the stress of New York City and my psychological profile and maybe the added stress of walking and doing all these workouts is just too much on my nervous system. And so first came the physical adjustment, but really it's a mental adjustment too, and acceptance. So
putting the devices away for a second and throwing them out the window, right? How important is body awareness, especially for women and in relation to menstrual cycles, right? Just check in with yourself, right? And I know that sounds much more easier said than done, right? But you can really start to understand the patterns of your body and what you're going through. And, you know, in week one, I feel like this. In week four, I feel like this. And this is how I feel in between. You know, for me, the week leading up to it, it's tough to get out of bed, right? And mm-hmm. I am sluggish and I am irritable and I just feel huge and everything about me just feels wrong. And I slow it down, right? I just focus on some zone two. I just, you know, I lift a little lighter. I'm not trying to do my block training, right? So yeah. I think body awareness is a huge piece there. And I think at times we become a little too reliant on some of these devices, as advanced as they are. And I've been wearing Whoop for 3.5 years every single day. I think I have thousands of days logged. But I think I do become a little dependent, because I'll see a red and I'll say, oh, I can't go and run that 7 miles today.
Especially if you're Ironman training, you want to be very specific.
Right. Or I'll see the green, but then I feel awful. It says 93%, but it feels awful. But I guess I have to go and push through that 3-hour block anyway. So how important is it to develop body awareness?
Well, the thing about the wearables is if you have an OCD personality, you know what you're signing up for. So if, you know, that's part of the reason why I stopped wearing the Apple Watch is because I would obsessively and just muscle memory wise check how many, if I filled the rings. And even if I didn't have it, it's just like if I didn't have ice cream, I wouldn't eat it. You know, if I didn't have it, I wouldn't check it.
Yeah.
And there would be more mental peace. So I think know yourself. If you're an obsessive type person and you know you're going to check it, well then work with your extreme mindset when you check it. And sometimes that's the thing. If it's you see the red, then it could be psychosomatic. Then you actually feel red. That becomes tricky. And you know, if you didn't look at it and you're like, I feel green. And then you look at it and I feel red. Then you're like, well, I know I feel green because I said it before I looked at it. You know, like,
yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, I think it's you know, I could tell, I've kind of, and I train myself with social media too. Like, I know the times of day when I go on to social media that I'll be more vulnerable and I'll just keep comparing myself. And you know, there aren't specific times of the day. It's not like 2 p.m. I feel more vulnerable. It's just like, okay, I know myself and I purposely try not to look at it because I'm protecting myself. And but I also know that, okay, there's parts of being able to see the watch and understand my body at the same time is important. So graduated exposure, if you will.
Yeah, so I mean body awareness really translating to actually just self-awareness at the end of the day and just knowing yourself best.
Right.
So yeah. You've mentioned it a few times. You're expecting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Let's talk about it. I'm very excited
let's
to talk
about
it.
About
let's
it.
Break it down. Seriously, you know, talk about, you know, we have here training for pregnancy, and that can mean a lot of different things, right? Or you said right before we started, how about not training for pregnancy and just taking a beat, right? Tell us, I mean, just walk us through your process and just walk us through the learning experience this has been, especially as an expecting athlete.
There's so much I want to say. I'll try to make this structured. But for me, I have my own experience, and that will influence my conversation here. And my experience was that, you know, I lost my cycle and I was working out too much, and then I stopped, you know, as of last year I took some time off. I'm not as extreme about working out, and I think it played a role into me being more fertile. And I think I wasn't planning to have a kid, and that moment happened, and I'm like, it was a big decision of like, okay, well, how am I going to prepare for this? You know, and then I accepted the fact that I'm going to be going on this journey. And then I'm like, okay, let me ramp my workouts back up because I want to stay fit through this. And then the doctor's like, no. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'll just go back to not working out, which helped me become pregnant in the first place. And maybe that's my body. I think, zooming out, there's a big shift happening for women, and it's, you know, there are these headlines, women are going to college more, and women are becoming the breadwinners more, and women are strong, and strong is the new skinny, and even though policy is regressing, women are, you know, becoming more aware, and women's health, you know, most scientific studies that are done on medicine are generally around men, and that ties back to military and protecting our country and a bunch of other things that I'm probably not aware of, but women's health is becoming more known, and it's building on this momentum that strong and strong workout and make more money and do it all. And like, well, wait, is that the best way? You know, women don't have to do it all, don't they? You know, to be worthy. It's your meaning of life is specific to you, and it doesn't have to be, you know, a breadwinner mom that's accomplishing it all. And, you know, for me, it's less about being a breadwinner and doing it all, and it's more about, can I maintain a good balance at the edges of my potential? And edges of my potential emotionally, edges of my potential professionally, edges of my potential physically, without, you know, compromising something. That balance is the challenge. And I think with women who are trying to get pregnant, understanding that, like, that background noise of women have to do it all, and I have so many thoughts about mothers trying to do too much already. Well, we'll see what happens. You know, I know there are a lot of alpha women that want to kind of do everything for their kid, and the guy's like, well, what about me? Like, or you know, I'll just go back to work. It's not like that, but I think there could be some shifts there. So working out specifically, I think it's really dependent on, you know, what your doctor says first, and mm-hmm. and you know, tying that into your overall values of, you know, first keeping the baby healthy, and or if you're trying to get pregnant, you know, are you trying to do it all? What are you trying to do too much of? And are you compromising your mental health? Are you compromising your nervous system? Are you, do you have irregular periods? So facing some of those truths first, it's all dependent. I don't know if I answered your question, but I think the message here is be aware of the overall narrative that's happening for women, and understand if you can deviate from that and still keep your balance, and how that could benefit you.
And you know, looking, let's say 6 months from now, right? What's your mindset? Is your goal to go back to be the athlete and to continue the training that you were doing pre-pregnancy? Has your mindset shifted given sort of, let's say, the downtime, right? And the downshift that you've quite honestly had to experience during this time, right? Has your outlook on your personal training tendencies changed during this?
Yes. My outlook on personal training for my clients has never changed. It really is about longevity and challenge. For myself, my mindset is I'm not worried about what I look like right now. I mean, yes, it's important, but there are a lot of other things that are more important, and specifically mental health. Big identity shift. I know that in the next year to 3 years really is going to be, I'm preparing for that, of the identity shift that motherhood brings. And there are a lot of resistance. There's a lot of resistance in me still, I could feel. So that is a priority. And, you know, being present is hard when you're not accepting some of those shifts. So I think it's more about the mental side and the identity shift that's going to happen. You know, identity shift from my professional life for a little, identity shift from how I used to perform. You know, your body definitely goes through physical traumatic experience having a baby, whether it's natural birth or a C-section. So it's, you know, your body can change for the long term. So I don't know. There's a bunch of unknowns that, once again, like if you're injured, going back to that conversation, if you have an acute injury, it's one thing, but if you have this like longer term injury that's just gonna hang around, and it's gonna change how you box jump, or it's gonna change how you run, or you might not be able to run as far, that's a different mental shift. So I think I'm capable of the mental shift. It's just about knowing what I'm going to be working with first.
Right, kind of reintroducing yourself to, you know, this post-pregnancy body, right? Mm-hmm. And just starting to understand what, you know, who am I now, and, mm-hmm. and what am I capable of now?
Do you want to have kids one day?
I do. Yeah. I do.
Could you imagine having one right now?
No, I can't.
Me either.
We're
in the same boat.
My partner is the opposite. He is like, when you are ready, I am ready. I'm like, that's fantastic to know, but I am not. he's the best.
Yeah,
but
you're the one that has to do it.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I don't. You know, for me, I'm still in that mindset of, I've come to realize that it's not an end all be all. You can still be the athlete. You can still, you know, achieve the same things that you're achieving now after. I'm not as naive to that as I think I used to. I think I used to view it as, oh my gosh, I have to accomplish all these things before I even think about having kids. It's not like that anymore. I think for me, there's still just things I want to go and do without having to think about someone else first. It's kind of a silly question, but I mean, how are you going to instill movement, you know, into your child's life, and how are you going to kind of set that standard or set that, be that role model of movement being such an important aspect of life?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the first thing that came to my head is that I want there just to be a lot of love and support, and that's priority. I think I want that to stay the priority no matter what. And, you know, shout out to my partner, because he's very supportive, and I don't think I'd be this confident and excited if I didn't feel the support from him. So men matter, and as parents, deeply, deeply matter. And are superheroes also. And I think the narrative for women is driven by the media. It's also driven by women for positive reasons, but the narrative that becomes in our subconscious, especially for men, might be that, you know, well, shit, being a parent, I don't have to do much because the woman does it all. And that's not true. No, it needs to be balanced.
Yep.
Especially for a woman's health, like, be there. Take 6 weeks off of work. You know, I know that sounds crazy, especially for bankers and lawyers. It sounds completely off the wall, but take that time. Really take that time and support your partner through her physical health so she could get some sleep and so you could bond with the child. Really. So I think men are superheroes also. I don't want to discount them, because it really is a team effort. And I think women can lean more into needing somebody, including myself.
I hear that wholeheartedly. I'm happy that you have that person, because I can attest to having someone pretty great too. And shout out to Ken, if you're listening. You should listen. This is our podcast.
No. And shout out to Chris, so people know his name. Thank you, Chris.
Yes, Ken and Chris. Awesome. One last question. You know, what's one piece of advice that you can give for expecting parents out there?
Oh, man, I don't know. Come on, that's a big question.
You got to end it big.
Advice for expecting parents. Wow, I mean, it's a big zoom out of life, and whether you planned it or not, I think it's such an exciting thing to happen. I mean, you're creating a human. It's insane. So I think that's just, you know, kind of mull over that excitement and live in it, because when else do we feel that excited? And that can carry into love and joy and just kind of really being present with that. I'd say don't think about the future. Just be in the now and, you know, be excited about whatever you're feeling.
a really great topic that we spoke about at large today, just staying in the present moment. Rachel Mariotti, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Tell our listeners where they can follow along on your journey.
You could follow me on Instagram, Rachel Mariotti. That's one R and two T's. And I just started a TikTok, so I talk about mental health on there with, you know, a bunch of bunnies and flowers and, you know, it's fun. Yeah, I'm more on Instagram. So if you follow me on Instagram, you can, you know, give me some love, send me a message. I'll follow you back. That's it.
Awesome. Give her a follow, everybody. And next time we have you on, there's going to be two of you here. So best of luck with the rest of your journey. Congrats again and wishing you well wishes.
Thank you so much. Thanks. And you too.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in for another episode of the BBCom podcast. Stay tuned for more stories along the way. Yeah.